The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Back to the bar counter. New guidelines expected to lift most restrictions on hospitality. As rents race ahead of inflation, when will the government introduce the promised rent cap? And cap in hand, where will there be a just transition for farmers in the carbon plan? We'll have all that and more on tonight's Late Debate. And joining us in studio to debate all of that, we have James Lawless, Fianna Fáil spokesperson on media, communications, networks and digital policy, chair of the Oireachtas Justice Committee and TD for Kildare North. Senator Marie Sherlock, Labour spokesperson for Employment Affairs, Media, Arts, Culture and the Gaeltacht. Mick Barry, Solidarity TD for Cork North Central. And Gráinne Nié, political reporter for thejournal.ie. We want to hear from you as well, so get in touch. Text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet at latedebate.rte. Well, earlier today, Labour leader Alan Kelly likened yesterday's announcement on COVID restrictions by the party leaders to the BBC satirical drama The Thick of It, saying their plans for reopening nightclubs and live events this Friday were both unworkable and incomprehensible. Then late this evening, it emerged that the new guidelines to be published by Fall to Ireland tomorrow night are set to allow almost a fully unrestricted reopening of the entire hospitality sector. The guidelines will restore most of the pre-pandemic operations for nightclubs and live music venues. That's according to leaks this evening. And we'll also lift the majority of remaining restrictions in pubs, restaurants and bars. Gráinne, if I can go to you first. Is it chaos behind the scenes in government buildings?
This is, I suppose, a confusing announcement, and Leo Varadkar said that, you know, it is easier to put restrictions in place than to lift them. But this did creep up bit by bit and over the past few weeks. One of the things that has happened before is NPHET warns the government when cases begin to rise. But this was kind of concerning politicians a lot before NPHET were having a look at it. And I suppose the kind of final stage, it wasn't a freedom day, but it was a kind of a soft final lifting of restrictions, if you want to put it that way, was meant to be kind of a full stop at the end of it. And this surge that NPHET are saying is partly caused by being close to the UK and partly caused by how high Delta rates were when we started vaccinating people, is kind of throwing a spanner in the works for government. And it's leading to things like messy rules around what happens in nightclubs, messy rules about, you know, an announcement this evening to say that the deadline or the curfew for weddings isn't going to be 11:30 anymore, but we're not going to tell you yet what it is going to be. It's just chaotic, you know, and this is all on Wednesday before the Friday where all of this is meant to come into force. It is really unclear for people, and I know government representatives and TDs have been saying this is always the way it's been, in the sense that there are guidelines that are contradictory and it isn't uniform and it all isn't kind of spread evenly across sectors. But some of this stuff is just not practical. It's not that it doesn't make sense or it's not cohesive. It's that it's just not enforceable with how people behave.
James Lawless, I know you were telling me you missed the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party meeting because you were busy at a Justice Committee meeting this evening. But we know that, because we know everything that happens at Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party meetings these days, that the Taoiseach said at that meeting that collective behaviour must change to level off the current increases in cases. And we know from earlier on today, Patrick O'Donovan telling us that, you know, we've let our guard down. Professor Philip Nolan saying at that briefing that this spike is because of a relatively small increase in mobility and the effect of social contact since the end of September. What's really I'm struggling with here on this is that we're hearing that we're mixing more. People have let their guard down, and this is why we have this increase in cases that we're dealing with. And yet we have made a decision to facilitate a much greater amount of social mixing among a cohort of people that we know are not as vaccinated as the general population. So how are we imagining that cases are going to go down in this scenario?
Yeah, so I think what we have is we have had a hugely successful vaccination program. I think by a number of metrics, in one table we were ranked a world leader, top globally, in terms of our vaccination rates, in terms of our reopening, in terms of where we've got to. The miracle of modern medicine is that we have a very successful vaccine, which is freely available in numerous locations, even apart from the vaccine centres all across the summer. When the third level colleges went back, there were vaccine programmes rolled out within each third level campus. And it's been a phenomenal success. We have very low rates of vaccine hesitancy, thankfully, in Ireland. We've largely an educated population. I believe in science. I think the vaccine is great. I can't understand why anybody wouldn't be rushing in to get it. And what we've managed to do was put in place a framework that, thanks to this scientific miracle, normal life can resume. And if you're vaccinated, you can pretty much enjoy the freedoms that...
Sorry. We've just been told that we have a situation where we could be facing into up to 200 people in ICUs.
Yeah.
This is the difficulty I think a lot of people are struggling with this, is that the messaging is all over the place.
Yeah. So the messaging comes from the Taoiseach and comes from government. Other spokespeople or other stakeholders may make comments. They can be helpful. They can also be a hindrance. I saw one person in the live entertainment industry recently citing Ronan McGlynn saying everything was all right. I heard other people tonight saying Tony Holland had said something otherwise. My message is listen to the Taoiseach. You know, he's the person that actually runs the country.
Collective behaviour must change
level
the current
cases. So, for example, I would be wearing my mask, whether it's mandated or not, on Monday morning when I got on the train from Salins, same as I did last week, same as I did the week after. That's a personal choice. I think the mask mandate is actually going to be extended anyway. The vaccine mandate. Why would we throw away? Now, you mentioned the numbers in ICU. The stats would say to us a large percentage of cases now in ICU are unvaccinated. If people choose to avoid a medicine that will help them avoid this disease, it's a personal choice, but there are personal consequences. One of which is you may get very sick. One of which is you may...
Can you just address the central contradiction in the middle of this? Is that we are facilitating further mixing while telling people that we will bring down cases
Because life goes on and, you know, we had...
Do you think cases are going to go down, given the decisions that have been taken, for good or ill this week? Do you think cases are going to go down?
I think the rate of illness in the vaccinated population will continue to decline. I think those people in the vaccinated population who may contract the illness will have lesser symptoms, will have lesser severity. I think there may be outbreaks in the unvaccinated population. There are people who choose.
What do you mean there may be?
Should
we see that we've over 2,000 cases today? What do you mean there may be outbreaks?
Yeah.
I'm saying we have 2,000 cases today. Yeah. We have 464 people in hospital.
So at some stage, we need to get on with real life.
I'm asking your opinion. Do you believe that from where we're at today, with the decisions we have taken this week, do you believe that our case numbers and the numbers of people in hospital and the numbers of people in ICU are going to go up or down?
I don't know. But I know that there are more metrics than what the case numbers are. You know, we cannot run an entire country.
So this is an acceptable level of ICU use, of illness, of hospitalisation.
We have a framework in place.
Is this the government's position, do you think?
I don't know. It's my position. I'm not the Minister for Health. We have a vaccine programme that is freely available to anybody that wants it. And a huge number have taken it up. And good luck to them. And I can't understand why anybody wouldn't. We have a framework that any premises in the country, be it a pub now, a nightclub, you know, a cafe, a restaurant, we're all getting used to sitting back around the tables. If you want to go in, you have your vaccine cert at the door, you wear your mask on the train, normal life can resume, subject to appropriate checks and balances. I have no problem wearing a mask for the next year if needs be. I have no problem showing my vaccine cert on the door of a cafe or the door of a pub that I'm going into. I want my elderly relatives, I want my mother, who's a pensioner, to have protection if she goes to have a coffee with her friends, not to have a table of unvaccinated people sitting and roaring at the table beside her.
There could be a table of vaccinated people beside her.
Yes,
given the levels that are now in the community, and they can be transmitting the disease.
They can be, but the statistics will tell us they're far less likely, number one, to contract it, number two, to transmit it.
No, hang on, that's not the case, actually. You are obviously less likely to get infected if you're vaccinated.
And if you do get infected, it'll be less serious.
No, you have the same viral load. This is what was explained to us very carefully this week by Killian the Gascoon, that if you are infected, even if you have been vaccinated, you have the same viral load, you have the same capacity to transmit.
Fatalities are far lesser than they were before.
No, you're protected personally, it's not right to say that vaccinated people do not transmit.
So over time, it may become like the common cold.
Let's open this up. Yeah, Marie Sherlock, I'm slightly surprised actually at what James Lawless has just said there, that we just go on. It doesn't, you know, if people are going to get sick, people.
I don't think anybody wants to see that.
I think firstly, Katie, in terms of the messaging here, and you said that there's been a lot of confused messaging, and my God, there has. Like, so we've been told that, you know, having the vaccination, by getting the vaccination, does not lower your transmission rate if you happen to still contract COVID. Obviously, it protects you against the worst.
Which is hugely important. Let's get that message out there still.
We have lots of people who are vaccinated who are getting
COVID. But in terms of the public health picture.
But in terms of this message about collective behaviour, I think really it's a deflection from the government's confused state at the moment as to what it wants. Like, ultimately, I do believe we need to see the economy open up, right? We have workplaces, workers, employers closed, particularly in the live events and arts sector, closed for 18 months now. So we do need to see them open up. But, you know, we need to not be clinging to this wing and a prayer that more people are going to get vaccinated, that we're going to see thousands more flocking to be vaccinated. The vaccination rates are, what, over 91% at the moment. Are we going to see 30 to 40% or 30 to 40,000 people get vaccinated in the morning to push that vaccination up to 92 or 93%? I'm not so sure, right? So we need to actually look at how we proactively keep people safe as we come into the winter. So number one, with regards to antigen testing, you know, we've been banging that drum for months now about antigen testing, and yet we don't have, I suppose we've belatedly heard from the government that they're going to send it out now to close contacts. Number two, with regards to the booster jabs, we listened to Mr. Donnelly today saying he'd like to have the booster or to have a third jab for healthcare workers. He's the Minister for Health.
He is dependent on NIAC, because from the very beginning we have said that we will be reliant on medical advice
but
on
we
that.
Need to hear those answers, and as Minister for Health he needs to ensure that answer comes as soon as possible. So I think the thing is, the government now need to get their act together in terms of painting a vision over the next number of months of how we're going to live, and an antigen test and the booster jab has to be part and parcel of that.
Okay, Mick.
In response to the question that you asked James, do you expect the numbers to go up
or go down?
I would expect the numbers to go up. I mean, we have nearly 100 in ICU now. We've nearly 500 in hospital. And we're going for an almost unrestricted reopening of hospitality. I do want to make a point about that. I want to make a point about hospitality workers. Because today we've heard from the restaurant industry. We've heard from the vintners. We've heard from the hotels. But we haven't heard from the hospitality workers, largely because they're unorganised, many of them not just in non-union employments, but in anti-union employments. But they're the people who are going to be on the front line here, okay? And I would encourage hospitality workers to have conversations among themselves in the next 24, 48 hours, to get together over the next 24 and 48 hours, and to act as workers to protect their own health and safety. For example, there are many, many pubs where showing the COVID pass either wasn't done or was a formality. Flash your phone. It wasn't looked at in a serious way. That's not a runner. And I think hospitality workers have to organise to make sure that health and safety is protected.
In relation to this idea of living with COVID then, you know, is there an acceptable level? Is that where we're at? I mean, for good or bad. I mean, that seems to be where we're going here. Is it that we will accept that a certain amount of our ICU beds are going to be taken up with COVID into the future?
But what I would say,
and quite
that,
a big percentage of them.
I don't think there's anyone arguing to lock the economy down for the winter. I think part of the problem
today NEFA did say that if things don't go well here, that they will have to consider further restrictions. So, I mean, could we be looking at another meaningful Christmas?
If there's a need for further restrictions, and that's what public health is saying, then we'll have to go down that road. But I'm talking about a complete shutdown of the society. I don't think anyone is looking for that, arguing for that.
No, anyone suggests that might be necessary.
Part of the problem here is that the government have left the health service in such a state that it's not in a position to cope with what is not a massive surge. It is a significant surge, but it's not massive. And that's a big part of the problem here as well.
Yeah, James Lawless, just that point, because Tony Holohan, I think, did frighten people a little when he made that point this evening, that if numbers don't come down, they're going to have to come back and consider what other measures might be necessary. What does that say to you?
As I said a second earlier, Tony is Dr. No, isn't he? I mean, that's kind of his style.
Tony is Dr. No?
Yeah. He's not the Taoiseach. So let's see what government decide. But I think government have decided, and the Taoiseach has consistently said, we need what reopen stays open. Okay, and this idea that, if you're all naughty boys and girls, that you might have to be locked down again, is not going to cut it anymore. We have been through the whole thing that kept us going through the dark winter and spring that we've just been through, was the promise of a vaccine on the horizon. Now we have it. We've got it into a huge percentage
of
the
population. But it hasn't worked as well as we had hoped.
It's worked extremely well. We're rated global first in a number of metrics.
We're quite up there in Europe in terms of our case numbers and our hospitalizations as well.
Case numbers are not the only metric. People contract it.
Hospitalizations and ICU, I think, were always the key metric, were they not?
There are consequences. You know, that is unfortunately a fact. I don't know why they would choose that, but some people do.
No, but sorry. It's not about people's personal. Our point here isn't it that we have a health service that if we have wards full of COVID patients, that means other people with their elected
surgery. Cillian de Gascoigne was very clear about this at the weekend, where he said he compared the uptake rate of vaccines versus the effectiveness of those vaccines. And the kind of, there's a mathematical equation basically to simplify it. It's not as easy to explain it on air. But basically, because with other vaccines, and he compared that with other illnesses and diseases, you reach a certain threshold that is able to suppress a virus from spreading or an illness from spreading. And basically, because Delta is so good at spreading, and because of the effectiveness of vaccines is not as high as they would have been originally, but they're still very, very high, they're not enough by themselves to give enough protection to suppress the virus, particularly because we can't give that additional protection to a certain cohort of the population and not everyone has the vaccine. And that is the fact of the matter. It's not ideal, but that's the situation we're in. And because of that, the government and NPHET have come out in the past few days to say, we need you to do these additional actions. We need you to act a little bit more. And if it develops after a couple of weeks that things are getting worse instead of better, it's a big statement for a government TD to say we just have to get on with it and not do anything.
Because that will mean elective, and when I say elective, I don't mean somebody's big toenail needing to be taken off. I'm talking about really serious operations that people very seriously need will not happen if we allow this to take over hospital wards and ICUs again.
Yeah, so I don't think I'm saying get on with it, not do anything. I think that's perhaps a little bit of a mischaracterization. What I'm saying is that COVID is going to be here to stay. Okay, COVID is not going to go away. We're not going to wake up in the morning, as perhaps we thought in the early days of 2020, and it will be gone. We have a framework to deal with it. We have a vaccine program. It's very useful to remind people of the basic steps. They've improved and been refined. You know, things like ventilation are now in the mix, along with the old sanitization.
Well, they're in the mix, and we're talking about it, but I don't really see any concerted plan about sorting out ventilation in hospitality, for instance.
Meeting I'm in, the windows are opened. School rooms, the windows are opened.
But like nightclubs, not a nightclubs won't have windows that you can open.
Well, perhaps nightclubs. Maybe that's...
Or restaurants, or pubs.
Yeah, well, actually, restaurants do. Most restaurants, certainly any place that I've been to, generally there is...
No, but it's just, what I'm saying is that it's totally ad hoc. It's about somebody walking over and opening a window. There seems to me to be no framework. I haven't seen any framework in place that we'll have an actual system where we can ensure for workers and for people who are punters in these places that there will be uninfected air in the place they are spending their money.
That's the whole point. There is a system which has been rolled out extensively and very successfully, which is the vaccine certificate.
No, in terms of ventilation, I'm asking you about ventilation.
Yeah, I understand.
We have all accepted that the vaccination program was hugely successful. Yeah, we have an enormous number of people vaccinated. We're talking about the other measures.
There are some advocating to abandon the vaccine certificate and say free entry. You know, I had people on to me last week about it saying, oh my God, how come we have to, you know, get your vaccine certificate at the door? Because this system works. In terms of ventilation, that's one of the new measures in the mix. So I think it's useful to remind people the mask mandate on public transport and congested settings. A lot of this at this stage is common sense. You know, you would think people wouldn't have to be told to wear a mask.
But it seems to me that all the things that we're being told about are things that individuals, the responsibility has been handed over to the individual. When it comes to issues that perhaps the government should have stepped in and had programmes in place to ensure, for instance, that ventilation systems were in place in schools, in places where every public gathered.
Yeah, there is guidance given to schools and was given last year. You
know, there's guidance to open windows. We don't, that there is no checking.
Well, no,
we don't know which school has good ventilation, which school doesn't
Let's have a look at schools, because James talks about a common sense approach. Was it a common sense approach to abandon track and trace in the schools? Was that a sensible step when you look at, for example, the school in Wexford? I think a lot of people would have applauded the stand that was taken by the principal. Is it Vicky Barron there? Common sense when she said this was a school outbreak, and the answer back to her was, well, it wasn't a school outbreak. It came from the community. And she said, did it come out of the walls? Did all of the students come in individually having contracted COVID from the community and just happened to be in the school? That was a school outbreak, I think, quite clearly. And certainly one common sense thing that needs to be done is to support the stance of the principals and to support the stance of the teachers and reinstate track and trace in our schools. That's a very simple point.
Yeah, now there is another view on that, but Marie, where does Labour stand on this?
Yeah, well, look, the thing is, you know, we're at a stage now where one size does not fit all. And again, you know, and I agree with Mick, like, as in, you know, I think people applauded Vicky Barron in Wexford for closing her school because she had to do that in circumstance to protect her staff, to protect her students.
She was only allowed to stay closed for a day.
But, and that's it. And she was forced to reopen again, right? And we haven't had those conversations. And we saw the principal network come out this evening and over the last number of days. You know, we haven't, there hasn't been an allowance for those conversations to take place between schools and public health. Because I know the schools in my constituencies, we've got brand new schools where opening a big window will allow a lot of air in. But there's lots of other schools that are in very decrepit buildings where, to be honest with you, you'd barely be able to open the window. So really and truly, you know, facile statements like, you know, open the window and we'll have ventilation, that doesn't cut it anymore. There has to be engagement directly with the schools. And if a school, you know, if students need to be contact traced, then that needs to happen. But ultimately here, in terms of our preparation, right, we have not used the last 18 months to get our hospitals into a situation where, you know, we have always known that COVID is far from over. And that there will be, you know, with all the mathematical modelling, that there would be, you know, a fourth and fifth waves. And we're coming into this winter and we know that there's an increase in respiratory infections alongside COVID and all the backlog in all the many other issue health areas, and we still don't have sufficient ICU capacity to deal with even the everyday issues, let alone the COVID. If we're going to see a real spike in those figures over the coming weeks,
okay,
that's really concerning.
I just want to let Grainne in. Grainne, do you know, were you listening to Philip Nolan today in relation to that contract tracing in schools today?
Yeah, it's important. So one of the things Philip Nolan said was in relation to the spread of COVID among children. He gave the example that the vaccine is not available to kids under the age of 12, obviously, but that the rate of COVID or the number of cases of COVID-19 in the population is evenly spread, despite that cohort of under 12s not being vaccinated. So that is kind of evidence, he said, demonstrated, and backed up by other studies that we're not going to get into, that the spread of COVID-19 among children is much lower than among unvaccinated adults, for example.
Yeah, he was saying that when they were doing that contact tracing, the level of positivity they were finding in those tests was 2-3%, and obviously it was hugely disruptive.
They were saying
to take all of those close contacts out of school while they were waiting for those.
There is a certain I was looking at this when the schools first came back after the lockdowns last year in September. Last year, and there was an understandable mistrust between the school organisations and what public health were doing. When public health said that child is not a close contact, they're fine to go into school, there was an unease about, well, but he's the brother of someone who is also out, or, you know, people were kind of doing their own detective work, to put it that way, and it created a kind of atmosphere of fear of this virus. The fact of the matter is the benefit of schools to kids is unquestionable, and in-person learning and the social skills that go with that is unquestionable, and the weight of protection that kids get from being young and unvaccinated is pretty low. As you were saying, the positivity among kids that were tested in schools was below 5%, but it was much higher from children that were in other settings. I think it was up to 25% in other settings, whether it was kind of parties or sleepovers or extracurricular activities. So it's important to not dramatise the school situation, because I know it is very stressful for parents and for teachers, but the benefit for the children themselves that have already missed out on education is unquestionable.
I'll just give you a sense of what our listeners are telling us. A bit of support for you, James. How remarkably refreshing to hear a TD say that case numbers aren't the be-all and end-all. Another email: I'm living in Waterford, where 99.9% of people are vaccinated, yet we have the highest or one of the highest COVID rates in the country. We have to live with COVID now. It's here to stay. Our health system was in tatters way before COVID came along. Fix our healthcare system. That's in an email. And a couple more about the healthcare. I've one, a hospitality worker, Mick. I'm a hospitality worker. All I want is to get to a gig this weekend, to stand in a crowd of vaccinated people and enjoy a bit of live music for the first time in years. And I'm sure many, many, many people will agree with you there. And then a couple more worried about the hospital. Hospitals will be overwhelmed. We will be back to square one, says one texter. And another: the dam wall is about to break. The annual overload of trolleys and hospital corridors is coming. That happens without COVID anyway. Disaster, says that texter. In relation to those booster vaccines, James Lawless, what is the story? Because we know now NIAC is saying we could give them to the over 60s. And that, I think the minister said this is going to start happening from November. When are we going to get more details on this? Because a lot of people in that age cohort, very nervous now with the, you know, the rates of it in the community getting higher, and them feeling that, you know, they may not be as protected as they thought they were.
Yeah, so NIAC has recommended that boosters be available for people, I suppose, 60 and over. And I think that's part of the adapting to the variants. And you know, we've heard about Delta being so much more transmissible, and after Delta comes Epsilon and all the rest of it. And we know that I suppose the variants are coming from pockets of the world with low vaccinations, and there is a point about maybe vaccine equality, which maybe we'll come on to later in terms of...
Well, actually, no, do you get that now? Because that is an important point.
I think it
may be lost in this debate. Is it right to be giving people who have a fair level of vaccine of protection already a very scarce resource, which is, you know, further vaccines?
Yeah, so I suppose I serve on the Foreign Affairs and Defence Committee as well, and we did discuss this there, and I support the idea that we should be exporting vaccines to parts of the world that can't access them themselves. We should do that because we're part of the global commune ourselves anyway, but also we should do that because, I suppose if we're selfish about it, if we don't do it, as long as there's pockets of the world that have the virus rampant, it's going to come back around onto us in the form of a variant. So I think it's the right thing to do, but it's also the clever thing to do.
Yeah, but... do that before you start giving booster shots?
Well, I think you've got to weigh up where you're at. But I think, just, I suppose, in terms of the reason that boosters may be important is because... And the other thing I suppose you'd say is that, in a way, it's a victim of success, because the people that got the virus, the vaccine shots earlier in the year, or perhaps maybe in some cases 8-9 months on now, and, you know, perhaps their protection isn't quite as robust as it was in those few weeks.
Philip Nolan did say today that there isn't evidence as of now of waning immunity or waning protection from those shots, but that, you know, you have to be prudent and plan ahead.
I'm just
trying to get an answer for you. Are you saying you would rather see the vaccines we have now be exported rather than be put into the arms of the over 60s?
My personal opinion, I think, is we've got to share the wealth. In this case, the wealth is the vaccine. I think we've got to do a part as part of an EU-wide...
I'm wondering, is that a yes?
Yes.
Yeah, you don't think we should be doing the booster programme then?
Well, look, again, we listen to the science. We listen to Philip Nolan and his colleagues and the NIAC recommendations. But if it's a case that there's strong immunity and there are pockets of the world that have not yet got vaccine equality, then I think it's something we need to have a serious think about.
Is that a good point? I can't remember who said it in the last number of days, but like, if there are healthcare workers dying because they can't get access to a single dose of any vaccine in all over the world, actually, in many, many parts of the world now, is it ethically right for us to be giving third shots to people here who have good protection now?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that it's a bit ironic to hear, James talking in support of, I suppose, vaccines, particularly in poorer countries. During the summer, the Labour Party and a number of other parties spoke about a TRIPS waiver. So effectively waiving the patient on the vaccines, particularly for developing countries. Now, we didn't get government support on that. And, you know, that would have been one very clear mechanism of ensuring cheap access to the vaccines across the developing and emerging developing world and emerging economies. And so, you know, to answer your question, Katie, you know, to my mind, we now need to vaccinate healthcare workers in this country, particularly those who are, you know, working in ICUs or are in contact with those who have COVID. We need to ensure that the most vulnerable parts of the population, those who are medically vulnerable, need to get that third booster.
So we give our healthcare workers a third shot ahead of healthcare workers in other countries who have no shots.
Let me finish. And we make sure, right, we do everything in our power to make sure that there are vaccines sent to third world countries. But it's part of, like, is in...
But you this know, is a scarce resource.
Of course.
Right. So you can't give it to everyone.
No, but we're part of an EU purchasing programme here. So this is not just about what Ireland does. Like, this is right across the European Union. So I absolutely, you know, believe we need to help third world countries get vaccinated. But the thing is, the government didn't support us during the summer when we were raising this issue about making those vaccines cheaper. And I suppose what I'm saying here is that, like, we have to see healthcare workers vaccinated. Like, the government are supporting that, but they're saying they don't know when they're going to do it. I think there's cross-party support for healthcare workers to be vaccinated, but we just need to see it happen sooner rather than later.
Why are vaccines a scarce resource? Is there not the industrial capacity to produce sufficient number of vaccines within a relatively short period of time to vaccinate the entire world? Is it because the vaccines are controlled by pharmaceutical corporations, but you're operating on a for-profit basis rather than a for-need basis?
With the support of the EU, though, the EU is against the TRIPS waiver, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the Irish government, even though they've tried to hide their colours on it, in reality is backing that position as well, in my opinion. So what we need to do is to do two things. First of all, we need to waive the patents at the World Trade Organization so that you can have generic production of the vaccines and not just controlled by a few big corporations. But we also need to have an urgent debate about who controls the corporations and is there a need for public ownership of the pharmaceutical industry to produce vaccines for need rather than for profit. On that basis, there's not a difficulty with, if public health recommend that this is the way to go, looking at booster programmes.
OK, James Lawless, just before we leave the whole COVID issue for now, what happened to our bank holiday and our COVID bonus?
I don't know. My own view is that, it seems to have gone off the radar a little bit in recent weeks. I think the bonus was perhaps an idea that grew legs.
Not gone off the radar for healthcare workers?
Nor teachers, nor many other sectors. But I think...
Watching very carefully.
I think it was an idea that was...
For anyone who can't see that, Mick is giving very meaningful looks to James across the studio there.
As somebody with members of my direct family involved in the union movement and indeed in public sector employment, it's been watching a number of places, not least my own household. So we're not all, you know, no one has the exclusive right to represent workers. I was a member of union myself, actually branch secretary at one stage. So we all have, you know, our own ideologies and our own persuasions, but our own approaches that might differ. I think the bonus idea kind of grew legs and grew frog's legs and fell off the table and ran away. And, you know, it really became very difficult because, okay, so we start off and say the healthcare workers are deserving and needing. And, you know, I think we'd all probably all certainly sign up to that. And then we say, well, the Gardaí were on the front line and the teachers were on the front line. And they were, absolutely. And then the retail workers on the front line and every checkout.
So what is actually happening? Are there talks? What's happening with it?
Well, I don't sit at cabinet, so I don't know what the latest is on that. But I suppose the idea became that every single worker then had a claim, in most cases, legitimate, you know, reasonably strong.
So it just became too much. So we just stopped talking about it. about it?
I think the bank holiday idea seems to have gained traction. The bank holiday is possibly a better idea because something that everybody, you know, public sector, private sector, can avail of, something that people will benefit from.
Except for
frontline
workers.
There might be a small gripe from maybe large employers, but, you know, they might have to just get on with it. And I think the bank holiday idea is something that's in the calendar. It's not a one-off either. It's something that's there. It's an extra bank holiday. It's an extra public holiday every day of the year, you know, for posterity. And perhaps it could be used as a sort of tribute to, you know, people that were lost in the pandemic. So that I think that may well come to pass. It was announced recently that I think by the end of November we'd know. As with the next debate moves on to when is it? Is it a November holiday? Is it a February holiday? You know, there's talk about St. Bridget's Day, props to match St. Patrick's Day, gender equality.
So is it still on? Is that what you're saying?
As far as I know it is. As far as I know,
we're still going to do that.
Frontline workers ain't going to settle for crumbs off the table. Crumbs off the table and, you know, just we'll give you a bank holiday.
Just as well Fianna Fáil isn't government representing them then, isn't it?
79% of people polled by MRBI said that they believed that public sector frontline workers should have a COVID bonus. And a majority said that private sector workers, such as, for example, retail workers, cleaners, nurses, home helps, should have a bonus as well. And the idea that it's just going to be a holiday, this needs to be a real
bonus.
Well,
as a union man, you know that a holiday has a monetary value and you know that workers actually receive a monetary reward if some workers have to work through a bank holiday. When I was union representative,
but
that's the kind of thing I would have been arguing for.
But why not look at something like this, Kevin? Why not look at something like this? Why not say...
universally in something
sorry,
like
James, you've been talking there quite a bit. Why not say that low-paid workers played a key role in helping society through this pandemic? Retail workers, cleaners, home helps, etc. Many of them did it on wages that you'd hardly be able to pay the rent on. Why not have a discussion as a lasting monument to their contribution of a genuine, decent national minimum wage, and why not have it at €15 an hour?
Well, the minimum wage increased in the budget last week, so that's a start.
By 30 cents.
Quite a bit off €15 an hour. This is a very big topic of discussion, which we will have to come back to on another night. I need to take a break. Before we go, just... an email finally on this. Very hard to listen to this, says this listener. My partner is 55, fully vaccinated and is critical in ICU tonight. I think he thought, like many, that he had protection despite underlying conditions. The message is not clear. And we wish you and your partner the very, very best on that. We'll take a break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald called on the Taoiseach today to immediately introduce a ban on rent increases. That's after the Residential Tenancies Board said that rental inflation had now reached 4.3%. Here's how that went.
There is more bad news today for renters, as the RTB calculator reflects that rent inflation now stands at 4.3%. I think it a disgrace, Taoiseach, that the government has not showed up for renters. There was nothing in your budget for them. We told you when you linked rent to inflation that it was too little too late. And we asked you, and I want to ask you again, to move for a ban on rent increases for 3 years. And to put a month's rent back in renters' pockets by way of a tax credit. That is what is needed.
Your view on tax credit could simply just fuel inflation even further. I mean, that's just the supply is the key issue to getting rents down. That is the key issue. Constitutionally, we cannot ban rents for increases for 3 years, simply cannot. And that's the advice that we have received. I know Northern Ireland, you know, it's in double digits, the increases. Your party is in charge of housing in Northern Ireland and you haven't waved any magic wand in respect of getting rents down or getting the housing issue resolved. So I think supply is the key issue. And also in terms of very significant resources are being made available in terms of rental supports for low-income renters.
And that was the Taoiseach responding to Mary Lou MacDonald in the Dáil earlier. I don't know if you could hear Mary Lou under her breath there saying, such an absolute spoofer. James Lawless, what is the story with the rent cap? Because I understood after the budget that we were going to get a rent cap.
Well, in July, there was already a rent cap of sorts introduced where rent can only increase at the rate of inflation, which is typically 1% over the last year. So that's already been, so when the RPZs were introduced, 2018, 2019, they were added to different areas, red pressure zones, there was a up to 4% increases allowed year on year. Since July, it's 1%. Well, it's in line with inflation. So effectively, rent was frozen, and then there was an allowance for rent to creep up in line with inflation. That's already the law. That's already there since July. I listened to the exchange there.
We knew that, yeah. But I'm saying after the budget, when there was a big furore because there was no mention of renters in the budget, the line that came out from government was that the Minister for Housing is going to introduce a rent cap to keep it underneath in the inflation levels. Because inflation was taking off at such a rate.
Yeah, well, I think that may be still being examined, but I think that the measures that he took in July are probably more meaningful. It's possible he'll go further. Just listen to the Taoiseach's response there. It doesn't sound like that's the current thinking. I'm one of those people that, even though I'm a lawyer, I don't think the Constitution should be used as a cure for all ills or as an excuse to not do things. There is a point, however, on the constitutionality of it, but I think we can get past that if that was the only issue. I think rent credits aren't the worst idea. I think there's some merit in that proposal. I do take the point about inflation. Inflation can be good or bad depending what side of it you're on. If you're mortgage to the hilt, inflation might be the worst thing. If you've money in the bank, maybe it's not such a good thing. I suspect most renters would be in the former position or mortgage holders. So I suppose I think the point before was that when mortgage interest relief was there, that it became a loading onto the price of a house rather than being a rebate to the mortgage holder. Not necessarily sure if
Sorry,
I share that view.
Okay, you don't think you don't earn any more than the rest of us, but you don't think that this rent cap that we heard about last week is now still on the cards? Is that what you
I haven't heard it spoken about in recent days. But as I said, in July, there was a rent cap is worth put in where rent cannot increase by more than inflation, which is basically 1% in the last year.
Inflation is more than 1%.
If you look at the
RTP
index, it'll tell you 1.01 in the year gone by.
The Minister for Housing is going to end up with more caps than Robbie Keane. I mean, he had a 4% cap. Now it's the rate of inflation, and I think the indications are that they are going to bring in a new cap, which would be less than the rate of inflation, whether that's 3% or 2%. As far as renters are concerned, there's only two caps that they're interested in talking about. First one is a rent freeze, which, by the way, was voted down in the Dáil tonight by Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party, the vote on that Sinn Féin motion. Or actually rent cuts, which many renters are saying that's what's needed now. Just very briefly, the Taoiseach in the clip there said that he's against a tax credit to benefit renters on the grounds that it would be inflationary. Well, you could debate that for and against. But I didn't see him so concerned about inflation when the landlords came knocking on the door, increasing the rents, or in the budget when the government introduced not one, but two Help to Buy schemes, which probably add 10, 15 or 20,000 to the price of a house. So when it suits the landlords or the developers, it's one thing. When it would help the renters, for Fianna Fáil, it's another.
I'll let you come back on that, James, in a moment. Marie.
Yeah, we absolutely need to have a rent freeze. And, you quoted the RTB figures today. We know from the CSO, private rents are increasing by 5.9% in the year to September. So certainly way ahead of where earnings are at. And of course, posing a huge issue for anybody who's renting at the moment. The Labour Party, when we launched our renters bill in during the summer, we talked about that we need to have a register for transparency in terms of a renters register so that you can actually see what the rent was in the property before actually renting a new place. And I think that's vital, as along with the idea of the rent credit, which I absolutely support, because how are people to be ever able to save a mortgage?
The rent credit can only work, am I right in saying this, if there's a rent freeze? Because you could see how a rent credit would.
Of course. But the key thing is, the Taoiseach today spoke about supply being the only show in town. But when I look in the area where I'm based in Dublin Central and I look at the supply that's coming down the tracks, there's 4,500 units either going through the planning system or under construction at the moment that is either built to rent, co-living or student accommodation, beyond the affordability of most working people out there, and only about 2,500 conventional apartments. So, we have a very real issue in certain parts of this country and this city with regards to the types of supply that are being rolled out. And it has been government policy not to ensure that conventional apartments are being built in this city because, of course, developers are going to the least common denominator now, squeezing the most amount of units onto sites and in particular built to rent.
Yeah, Grainne, that is an issue. And I know even today we were seeing figures about the buy to rent levels of rent. In a scheme, cost rental, in Leixlip in Kildare. This latest scheme by the housing body Clwyd, 56 new homes available for rent in Barnhill Meadows, €900 per month for one bed and €1,250 for a two bed.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the crux of the issue. All these schemes and plans sound really good, and then when you bring it down to the cold hard cash and the average earnings, we're talking about minimum wage earlier, what can people afford? And if you look at other countries, you know, Australia is one example, rent is around a third of your income, and for a lot of people who are renting, it is closer to half of their income. So if we're talking about inflation, I mean, I would have assumed the inflation was rent inflation rather than general inflation. And that has gone up by 4.3%. So if they're matching it to that, it's going to be slightly around the same rent cap that they're getting rid of 4%, which didn't work because landlords just increased it more than that anyway, and it wasn't being kind of properly monitored. There weren't enough controls and checks in place to ensure that renters are protected when there's no point setting these rules and these targets to protect renters from extortionate prices if there's no system that's going to properly support them if they raise when these rules are broken. So there's a whole system here that is not being properly tackled, wasn't tackled in the budget, it wasn't tackled in Housing for All. So you're kind of left holding your hands in the air and waiting for some sort of big announcement. I don't think it's too cynical to say I don't expect much.
James Lawless, I think that's a difficulty, isn't there? There's a lot of renters out there now don't expect much. They really feel like they've been left behind and forgotten here.
Yeah, and I suppose, again, it's all about supply. The entire housing crisis, I think, is all about supply.
Just to that exact point that Marie raised there, we have supply coming down the tracks, but it's for apartments that are being put on the market at rents that are way, way beyond people can afford.
Well, the scheme, I think, is a cost rental scheme. It's in my own constituency, Barnhall. The minister was out today to launch it. I think it's a start of, I think we'll see that more of that. I think cost rental was one of the big planks of the programme for government, that we would begin to do cost rental in this country. I think it's a positive thing. Those units would be very much welcomed in Leixlip and in North Kildare.
It's pretty pricey, though. €900 for a one bed.
Yeah, but it's probably cheaper than the open market would command for that at the moment. I don't know, but I think it's possibly. I know people come to my clinic are probably paying.
No, but I'm saying that's the best people can hope for. This is the absolute best, and you would need to have a fairly good salary to be able to support yourself, and if that's going to be a third of your income.
Sure, and I suppose if you look at the situation where that's a cost rental, that's not a for profit scheme. That's a cost rental.
That's what I'm saying.
So you have to work back from that. So there's nobody making a book out of that. There's nobody trying to go in with ulterior motives. That's actually the cost of building. That's the cost of land, etc. There's a variety of measures. The budget included the 3% levy on zoned land, use it or lose it type thing. Just come back to the inflation for a minute. Just had a quick flick there. The RTB maintainer, their website, they have their own index of consumer prices. It's sort of like a CPI index of their own. 2019 went from 100 to 100.8. 2020 went from 101 to 100.8. Actually came down, so there's negative inflation in 2020. This year, in the last couple of months, there has been a degree of inflation of the order maybe 2 or 3%. It does appear to be in the rise. But I suppose going back just to a point Mick said, that there was the 4% and the RPZ, and then it came to what was there now. The Minister for Housing, Darragh Ryan, is in the job about 12 months. He inherited an RPZ at 4%. In his first year in the job, he's cut that down to what was effectively certainly 1%. Now, as inflation has gone up and down, he's brought it back in line with inflation. So he's already made an impact. He's committed.
Sorry, I actually don't understand that point.
So
what impact has been made? We've been told that
year on year.
We've been told CSO are telling us that rents went up 5.5%. Is that the figure for last year?
Yeah.
So what is the big impact?
Well,
the minister has had.
How? Because if an individual household went up by 5.5%, they're breaking the law. So the tenants should report the landlord to the RTB.
Well, haven't we just heard from Gráinne that this is not enforceable? This is not being looked
it
after.
Is enforceable.
It's enforceable, but it's not being enforced, obviously.
Well, okay. The law is the law. But, you know, if people choose to break it, then there has to be sanctions for that. But, the government brings in laws. If people choose to ignore them, whatever, that's another day's work. That's about enforcement.
But you mentioned that supply is an issue. So if you report your landlord and they kick you out, where else are you going to live? Probably another house or room, which is as expensive or more expensive than the one you've just left. And this is the part of the problem that it's a confluence of issues. It's a lack of other options. It's a lack of a system that supports or prioritises renters in a housing situation. And if you want evidence of that, it's the lack of policy in any government announcements in the past 2 months.
Do you want to respond to that, James? Well,
just very briefly, you mentioned the 5.5%, and I heard that figure reported as well. But if you go to the RTB Rent Index, which is what the law works off, it's telling you it's 1.1% in 2020.
Just hear today that rents went up by 4.5% in the last year?
Yes.
From the RTB?
What the law says is that under the new rules, you use the RTB's own price index, and that is not 5.5%. So I hear what's being reported, but the law introduced in July...
To be clear, the RTB have a rent calculator.
Yes.
The RTB rent calculator currently shows the rate of rental inflation to be 4.3%, okay? So the minister actually, by pegging the rent to the rate of inflation, has...
Well, 3.3 since the start of the year.
It's currently 4.3%, right? So let's not talk about yesterday, the day before, or the day before that. Let's talk about now. It's 4.3%, and as your own figures show there, rising. So there's a need for a cap...
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's have a debate on what the cap is. I'm saying that there are only two figures that are worth talking about. Is it going to be A, a rent freeze, or B, is there some way of implementing rent cuts? Pegging it back to 3% or 2% ain't going to cut it with the renters.
OK, we've got 4 minutes left, and I wanted just, as I have you, James Lawless, you're chairing the Special Commission on the Aims and Objectives of Fianna Fáil. How's that going?
I'm really looking forward to the project. It's something I've just been tasked with in the last couple of weeks. We have our first, I suppose, meeting in earnest tomorrow. It's a really vibrant group made up of TDs, senators, councillors, ordinary members of the party. We will be consulting widely within the party, but also, just as importantly, if not more, outside the party. I think we have a set of values which would resonate with the members of the party, people who are in Fianna Fáil, people who represent Fianna Fáil, but maybe isn't quite understood by the wider public. And maybe that's a learning for us, maybe how we communicate, maybe how we tell people what we're about. I think often if we sit down with people and have the conversation, they say, God, yeah, that actually works. You know, I like what you're saying. I like what you're doing. Obviously, some people do. We wouldn't get elected, but I think actually, when we have lost some of our currency in terms of how we tell our story.
People don't know what Fianna Fáil stand for. Isn't that what Sean Fleming?
That's why I was given the job of re-establishing our aims and objectives.
Can I just say, the line from Sean Fleming's report is that the party is predominantly rural and highly reliant on its decreasing core base in defining itself. We were unable to distinguish ourselves sufficiently in the minds of many people from the government during the confidence and supply arrangement.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. That's why I've been given this task, which I'm looking forward to taking on. I think the line about predominantly rural was about the membership base. That's a challenge for us. We have been a broad church historically. We suffered during the global financial crisis. Most parties that were in government around the world took a hit at that time. I would agree the confidence and supply unfortunately blended us too much with Fine Gael at the time. I would say there are significant differences, but and I suppose it suits the opposition and it suits other parties to throw us all together. It's a narrative that's easy to portray and throw at us and say, oh, sure, you're all the same. And it's sort of a pro-establishment narrative. I don't agree to that. I think Fianna Fáil has been a radical party for a century. And I suppose it's up to me and my team now to go out and portray that again.
Marie, you're just suiting yourselves, throwing them all together.
Radical is one word. This is the party that got us into the financial crash and has supported Fine Gael over the last 5 years, and we have made no inroads. We have seen years squandered with regards to the health service and housing.
Okay, can I just ask you, because we only have a minute left.
So good luck to Fianna Fáil in terms of their aims and objectives. We look forward to reading them whenever
they're produced. Does the Labour Party need a commission on its own future?
Well, certainly we've had a lot of soul searching over the last number of years, but we have a really, vibrant parliamentary party group now. Ivana Bacic's win during the summer, I think, gave a huge lift to the party, but importantly as well said that we can go out and win seats. Ivana topped the poll and won votes from right across the political spectrum and across all ages. So I think, certainly we're in a good position and we're growing, and that's the really important thing.
Very quick, Mick, are you expecting a Labour surge?
No, I'm
not. Don't be too caustic now.
No, I'm not. On the thing about Fianna Fáil, what I find now is that when you talk to a lot of people about Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, they bracket them together almost as though they were one party. People don't necessarily talk about Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. They talk about Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and run it all together like it's one word. And I think that increasingly they're indistinguishable in the eyes of very many people. Perhaps people see Fianna Fáil as being somewhat different, as in being a little bit older and a little bit more socially conservative.
Okay, and that is all we have time for tonight. We will, no doubt, come back to this. Maybe you'll come back into us, James, when you've got a bit more work done on that one. So thank you all for coming in, and thank you all for listening out there. The producer tonight was Penny Hart. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Ciarán Dunn was on sound. Stay tuned for Late Date with Fiachna O'Brien on. But first, we hand you over to Greg Allen on the Sports Desk.